Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. Privacy advocates are expressing concern about a New York Times report today that the Social Security Administration and the Internal Revenue Service have been handing over Americans' private information to the FBI for its terrorism investigations. The Social Security Administration apparently relaxed its privacy policy 2 days after the September 11th attacks in 2001, and it's been that way ever since. To find out more, we're joined by Eric Lichtblau, the New York Times reporter who wrote today's story. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the Social Security Administration's privacy policy. What's happened?
Well, generally, the Social Security Administration has a very high bar for the release of any information from Social Security files. And unless you've been indicted or convicted of a crime, their policy bars the agency from sharing any information from its files with law enforcement investigators. What they did after 9/11, in the days immediately afterwards, and in policy guidance that was then updated as recently as last year, was to say that 9/11 was an exception. It was an extraordinary event with what they cited as life-threatening situations. And so they allowed their personnel to receive requests from the FBI and share information from their files, personal identifying information, addresses, sometimes medical information and things like that.
Okay, and it's still happening?
The policy is still in effect. What I was told by the Social Security Administration is that they have had no recent requests. But as recently as a year or two ago, the requests were still coming in, and there were thousands from people I talked to.
And what is the law enforcement value of this? I would assume that the FBI would have many other ways to try to get this information.
Yeah, I mean, the FBI certainly has a wide arsenal of databases already available to it, but they think that there is certain information that only the Social Security archives have that would be useful, particularly in trying to detect Social Security fraud. Since some of the 9/11 hijackers used fake Social Security numbers, they were running names and numbers of thousands of people, illegal immigrants, foreigners who were working in the U.S., things like that, who had obtained Social Security cards to see whether they were real or fake.
You mentioned addresses, telephone numbers, medical records. Is that the personal information we're talking about?
Right. Now, the other information that Social Security has is income-related, obviously, your earnings and wages that factors into Social Security. The Social Security Administration drew the line there. The FBI was seeking that information from them. They said, legally, we don't think we can do that, even though we have relaxed our standards. So they referred that to the IRS, which it's a little grayer area as to what exactly the IRS did with that information, but they did have agents that were working with the FBI physically at the FBI buildings and were sharing information from IRS files involving taxpayer information and financial data.
But you're not clear on exactly what.
Right. We're still trying to find out whether or not the IRS had to actually carve out an exemption to its policy to allow that the way the Social Security Administration did or not. That's a little hazy.
Now, are there requirements that when there are significant policy changes like this that affect quite a number of people, does that have to be made public?
Not necessarily. I mean, there are some members of Congress, Democrats, who are raising the question of whether or not the Social Security Administration should have come to them with this policy change and are complaining that it represented a significant shift in privacy policies that should have been debated publicly or at least told to Congress. But there's no specific requirement that I'm aware of that this type of change had to be publicized.
Or the reauthorization of
right.
it. Right. And how does the FBI say that it's safeguarding this information and overseeing the collection of it?
Well, they have a system in place, both the Social Security Administration and the FBI, as to who is authorized to request and receive the information. It seems to be a more rigid system at the Social Security Administration, where there are only 11 offices that are allowed to even receive these requests. At the FBI, thousands of field agents are at least technically empowered to make these requests.
If this has been going on since the September 11th attacks, why is it coming to light right now?
Well, there was an interesting Freedom of Information Act request from a group called the Electronic Privacy Information Center that obtained a bunch of records, including internal memos from the Social Security Administration just recently, just last month. I looked at some of those records and also did some interviews yesterday, and so that's why it's coming out now.
Mm-hmm. But it's not. Doesn't sound like it's the end of the story.
No, I think it'll probably keep going.
All right. Well, Eric, thanks very much for speaking
with us.
Thanks
for having me.
Eric Lischblau covers legal affairs for The New York Times. It wasn't that long ago that consumers depended on their physicians for information about the latest medications, but it's become increasingly common for patients to go to their doctor's office with a request for a particular drug. That's because federal regulations that once banned direct drug advertising to consumers have been relaxed, and now pitches for pills to relieve arthritis, erectile dysfunction, and obesity are as common as ads for laundry detergent and peanut butter.
Frequent heartburn sufferers like these are taking heart because they've discovered the amazing relief of Prilosec OTC.
New Vesicare can reduce urges and may even help relieve bladder leakage. So why wait? Ask your doctor today if Vesicare is right for you.
If you're eligible, the Merck medicines you need can be delivered to your doctor or right to your home.
There's no question these ads have been successful. They've spawned a $4.5 billion industry, making it the fastest-growing segment of advertising. In fact, a 2001 Kaiser Foundation survey found that nearly a third of all Americans have asked a doctor for a drug they've seen advertised, and almost half of them received it. While some argue the ads create better-informed medical consumers, others say the advertising drives up healthcare costs and encourages patients to demand expensive drugs they may not need. Joining us to discuss the effects of direct-to-consumer medical advertising is Wisconsin-based internist Dr. Kim Hetzko, who's also a trustee of the American Medical Association. Welcome, Dr. Hetzko.
Hi.
The American Medical Association met yesterday to consider supporting congressional efforts to ban direct-to-consumer medical advertising. Why did the AMA decide to get involved right now?
Direct-to-consumer advertising of drugs, pharmaceutical drugs, has been of considerable importance, as you've already mentioned.
And what did the association decide to do?
Well, they had there were actually six different resolutions that came forth. And we ended up referring them to a scientific panel within our organization for further study. Some people looked at the positive aspects of direct-to-consumer advertising in terms of potentially educating the public about diseases or illnesses or conditions. And while others pointed to the intrusive nature of some of these ads in terms of pushing drugs and medications to the more expensive ones and using new ones that may not have been studied as much as the old tried and true medications.
Mm-hmm. Until, what was it, 1997, drug companies were allowed, right, to pitch to physicians but not to consumers.
That's correct.
Is it more difficult now for doctors?
It is indeed, because patients now come in and ask for drugs by name, and physicians so often have to spend a lot of time discussing why a particular brand name drug isn't right for the patient, and they spend less time addressing the real needs of the patient, and that's of concern.
Mm-hmm. What about education in terms of having more educated consumers? I know that many drug companies say that that is part of the mission, and they cite the example of antidepressant medication advertising, and they say that that's actually brought about awareness of an illness that may have been more secretive before. What are your thoughts about that?
No, I think there's value to that, and some of the physicians spoke up in our hearings and discussions of these resolutions, and those would be considered by our scientific panel. However, there was also the very definite concern that the ads emphasize the benefits of these medications, and they don't necessarily point out the risks very well, and that a lot of consumers come in with unrealistic expectations or they do not remember or consider the risks.
Mm-hmm. Are there specific examples that you think are harmful to patients or very difficult for doctors?
Well, there indeed are, and there are ones that may have safety concerns in terms of drugs, such as the so-called COX-2 inhibitors, the anti-arthritis pain medications. and the demand was made very heavy for those because of the advertising. And as you know, several of them with a great deal of news coverage have been pulled from the market now because of the more knowledge about the increased level of side effects.
When we talk about a $4.5 billion advertising industry, can you look at that and see that there is or may be a direct link between healthcare costs and direct-to-consumer advertising?
That's certainly the concern of many physicians across this country is now that we've added this expenditure, $4 to $5 billion spent on just advertising of pharmaceutical agents to the public as something has to be recouped or gotten back by the drug companies from the prices they have to charge.
Mm-hmm. So what exactly is the association doing now in terms of a timetable to take up this issue again?
Well, we'll be looking at a report back by our meeting next June to look for a scientific study and have that scientific group within our organization report back on balance, looking at the positives and the negative aspects.
Mm-hmm. And where do you stand on it?
Well, I personally stand that there should be perhaps limitations. I'm a little upset when I'm watching television and I see during prime time sporting events during the day ads for erectile dysfunction, and my young children are watching the TV and watching the sporting event. I think there's a lack of taste, and some of that's highly inappropriate at those hours.
Mm-hmm. But mainly because of embarrassment and not because of the potential risks, or what's more troubling?
Both. It's inappropriate. I don't mind having those medications perhaps on later in the day or something, and I'd like to have a more balanced presentation of the potential risks of the medications that are on ads.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You bet. Have a great day, and I appreciate it.
Kim Hetzko is a Wisconsin-based physician and trustee with the American Medical Association. He joined us on the line from Chicago. Coming up, we look at direct-to-consumer medical advertising from the drug company's perspective. And later in the show, how some communities are taking steps to better keep track of sex offenders. Some are trying to ban offenders from areas where children gather. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We've been talking about direct-to-consumer drug advertising, which some doctors say is driving up the cost of health care and creating a demand for brand-name medications. For another perspective on the issue, we turn to Ken Johnson of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, a trade association for drug manufacturers. Welcome, Ken.
Hi, Deborah. Glad to be here.
You've, I'm assuming, heard the contention that these ads could lure consumers into demanding drugs that really may not be best for them. What would you say to that?
Well, we heard what's wrong with advertising, but when done right, advertising can also be a powerful educational tool. We know, for instance, that a recent Harvard study found that about a fourth of adult patients who saw their doctor after being spurred by an ad on television were diagnosed with a new condition. From our perspective, that's the power of information. That is the good that that advertising on television does.
Mm-hmm. I think that the chairman of your group of pharma, William Weldon, has acknowledged that the ads could inadvertently minimize both the importance and the risks involved with certain types of medications. How do you walk that line between educating and making sure that you're promoting your medications?
Well, clearly, we've got some work to do. While advertising, as I said, can be a powerful educational tool, we recognize that we've got to do a better job in the future. We need to make certain that television advertising fosters a better communication between patients and healthcare professionals. We believe it should include information about the availability of other treatments where appropriate. We think it should be designed to achieve a greater awareness of both the benefits and the risks associated with advertising with the advertised prescription medicine. And we also think that advertising should respect the seriousness of both the drug and the health condition they address. At times it may be appropriate to interject a little humor, but certainly nothing should be done in an ad that would sensationalize a condition.
And your association is actually pressing drug companies to unveil a voluntary code of conduct about.
That's right. Our president CEO Billy Tozan has been nudging the companies closer and closer to an agreement. It would be a voluntary code of agreement. We hope to take something to our board as early as July for action.
Basically, that voluntary code of conduct would include the things you just mentioned, or?
Well, those are the guiding principles. Those are just some of the things that we know in the future we should do to make advertising on television both educational and informative for consumers.
Mm-hmm. Some drug companies, like Bristol-Myers Squibb, have announced that they would not market new drugs directly to consumers for the first year after the drug is released. Do you think, because of the Vioxx case, that's a wise move?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we're not in disagreement with Bristol in the sense that there's a wide-held belief among our companies that there should be an appropriate time before advertising of a new product begins to both educate physicians and other healthcare professionals. But we also believe it's up to each company to decide how long that time period should be. So I suspect in the future it will vary company by company and product by product.
Mm-hmm. So the definition of appropriate is up to the drug company?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How does this advertising affect healthcare costs?
Well, I'm going to stun you. We believe it brings healthcare costs down. You know, people will constantly talk about, if you're spending $4 billion a year, then the cost of drugs must go up. But what we have to start looking at is what other healthcare costs are we bringing down and bringing down dramatically. We know, for instance, that a recent nationwide poll by Prevention Magazine about Men's Health found that 28 million patients talked to their doctor for the first time about a health condition after seeing ads on television. And we also know that every 1 million men who went to see the doctor requesting a prescription, say, for Viagra, doctors found previously undiagnosed diabetes in about 30,000 people. They found high blood pressure in 140,000 and heart disease in 50,000. Now, if those conditions had continued unnoticed, what is the cost to the system of 140,000 people who die of heart disease or have strokes? What's the cost to the system of 30,000 people who might potentially have to have amputations because of diabetes? So this is a double-edged sword, and we need to look at both sides of it.
These folks would not have seen a medical professional were it not for the ads?
Again, this was done by Prevention Magazine and Men's Health, and they found that 28 million patients talked to their doctor for the first time because of seeing an ad.
Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, do you think that there would be an effect to drug companies as well if these ads were somehow different than they are right now?
Well, they're already starting to be different. All you have to do is take a quick look at the Johnson & Johnson new ad for the patch. They're much more educational. They're much more serious. And they're directed toward the people who might have a condition or already have a condition that the product is designed to address.
Mm-hmm. Congress obviously is considering several measures regarding this direct to consumer medical advertising. And one of them, you mentioned Viagra, would implement guidelines as to when those ads are appropriate, when they could be aired on television. Basically, what would you say to that?
Well, it's part of our. Discussions in developing a voluntary code of conduct, one of the things that we are looking at is content and placement. There is serious discussion about having included in a voluntary code some type of agreement that would say that DTC advertising should be targeted to the appropriate audience and at the appropriate time.
Mm-hmm. So, but it would be vaguely worded like that.
Well, no, I mean, I don't know. Again, I'm just sort of giving you what the guiding thoughts are and the guiding principles. The actual wording of the voluntary code is still being drafted by pharma in consultation with company lawyers.
Who would define appropriate in that instance?
Well, I'm just not prepared at this time to get into the details of the code. But there is a growing consensus that we need to do this, we need to do it soon, and as I said before, we hope to have a comprehensive code to take to our board for a vote in July.
Mm-hmm. What about the plan to create an FDA office to review these ads?
Certainly there's a place for the FDA. We are in consultation with both the FDA and the FTC. When we have a final code to share with them, we will. But we recognize that FDA has to be part of the process in some way.
Ken, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Ken Johnson represents the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Tomorrow on Here and Now, some call them the most despised family in Canada. They admit they're members of Al-Qaeda, and their 18-year-old son was captured in Afghanistan, but his lawyer says he's being illegally detained at Guantanamo Bay. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The man authorities call the most active sex offender in U.S. history is in court today. Dean Arthur Schwartzmiller is being arraigned on felony molestation charges. Police say they found records in his San Jose home, including lists of some 36,000 sex acts with children. This case comes during a recent spate of horrific sex crimes, which are leading many communities to take steps to keep closer tabs on convicted sex offenders, such as banning offenders from living near places where children gather. A group of sex offenders in Binghamton, New York, is now challenging such a law there. Joining us first on the line is the group's attorney, Dennis Kaufman, of Legal Services of Central New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us about the law in Binghamton.
Well, the law in Binghamton is probably the broadest we've seen around the country. It not only prohibits ex-offenders from living within a quarter of a mile of certain locations, but it effectively bans them from even being present within most of the city of Binghamton.
Certain locations such as?
Oh, such as everything. If you have to go to the courts, if you have to go to a city, county, or state agency, if you have to visit your doctor or go to a hospital, all of those kinds of services are in the forbidden zone.
And that's a buffer zone, right?
Yes,
right?
It is.
But communities are understandably nervous. There have been several high-profile cases involving sex offenders recently. How should communities protect children?
Well, there's no doubt that communities do have a legitimate concern about the safety of their children. We think that laws like the city of Binghamton's, however, is not narrowly tailored to respond to the real risks that are associated with those who are most likely to reoffend. It cuts broadly across. It sort of hijacks the state system of determining who's a sex offender and says that any of these individuals are exiled or banished from the city of Binghamton.
So would some of the other measures in other states be more effective, say, color-coded license plates that are being proposed in Massachusetts and Ohio to identify sex offenders, or GPS systems?
I'm not sure that even that kind of drastic means of identifying sex offenders is going to be effective. If you talk to people who work with sex offenders, basically what they're trying to do is get that person into a stable situation where they have a home, that they're in treatment, that they have employment. This continual marking of individuals or moving individuals around is very counterproductive to that kind of effort.
Where does your legal challenge stand right now?
Right now, we are awaiting a hearing before the Federal District Court that has been set for July 13th. But in the meantime, we've been assured by the attorneys for the city of Binghamton that they will not arrest any of our clients.
Well, Dennis, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Dennis Kaufman's Executive Director of Legal Services of Central New York. He's representing 15 sex offenders who are suing the city of Binghamton about a law that effectively prevents sex offenders from being in certain parts of the city. To further discuss this, we now turn to Ernie Allen, who's President and CEO of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Welcome, Ernie.
Thank you, Deborah. Glad to be with you.
Ernie, this particular law in Binghamton regarding buffer zones, do you think it's an effective way to try to protect children?
Well, there have been a growing number of these kinds of laws around the country, and the one area where I certainly am in agreement with Dennis is that I think they need to be narrowly enough prescribed that they're not overbroad. Certainly, it is understandable, and we support the concern of communities about keeping offenders from living in close proximity to elementary schools and playgrounds and places where children are likely to congregate. But we have to be careful that these laws don't exile these offenders. The reality is that most of the convicted sex offenders in America are not in America's jails or prisons. They're in the community. And our view is that it's most important that law enforcement and official authorities know where they are. In recent cases, there's been example after example of offenders with multiple priors gaining access to kids, harming kids, and authorities not even knowing where those offenders are.
So what would be a more effective way of keeping track of them? Would it be a more narrowly prescribed buffer zone law? Would it be a GPS system, license plates? What would it be?
Well, I think it's some combination of all of that. One of the reasons why it's so difficult to keep up with these offenders, and we certainly recognize that those offenders who represent the greatest risk are the ones who are least likely to be compliant with registration laws, is to use technology to help hard-pressed state and local officials keep up with these guys. They move. They are highly mobile. They seek legitimate access to kids. So I think the use of GPS technology, at least during that probation and parole period, is a common-sense, relatively low-cost means of helping law enforcement track and stay aware of where they are. Other means like color-coded license plates and that sort of thing, I think, are probably a little less compelling. We agree with the attorneys for these offenders that we want them to succeed. We want them to stay crime-free and to live normal lives. But they have sacrificed some of their right to privacy because they have committed sex offenses for which they have been convicted in a court of law, and the data make it abundantly clear that overwhelmingly the victims of these offenders are America's children.
A couple of things there. Is a sex offense always a sex offense? In other words, are there different layers of the crime, really?
There really are, and I think that's an important point. One of the things that we try to make very clear is that all sex offenders are not alike. There may be some sex offenders who commit an offense as a matter of a lapse of judgment. The research indicates that among the most serious offenders, the typical child molester will victimize at least 100 children during his lifetime. Those who victimize young boys victimize as many as 300 children. So we would argue that there needs to be meaningful assessment of risk, and that the offenders who represent the greatest risk to reoffense are those that we need to use the broadest array of tools and techniques, not only to keep track of where they are, but to alert the community of their presence.
Mm-hmm. With communities taking these approaches like buffer zones and GPS systems and license plates and things like that, aren't they already saying that these registries may not be the most effective?
What we and others are saying is that we need to more effectively implement and enforce the systems that are in place. There are 550,000 registered sex offenders in the United States, but according to the latest estimates, as many as 100,000 of those offenders are non-compliant, literally missing, that they are supposed to be living in a house in one community, but they're not there. And we think those offenders represent the greatest risk.
Well, Ernie, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
Ernie Allen is president and CEO of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. You're listening to Here and Now. The fact that the French voted no and the Dutch voted nay to the European Constitution has troubled a lot of people, but not commentator Alice Furlow. Alice lived in France for many years, and she calls herself a gastronomic nationalist. We asked her to explain.
I got a shock early this summer. I was driving along, listening to a public radio station somewhere, and the announcer kept offering a present to listeners who contributed to the station. He said the present was a big box of European chocolates. European chocolates! My heart sank. It sounded as if all the countries in Europe, not content with merging their laws, had even agreed to melt down their chocolate and mix it all together and call the result European. When I got home, I called the station, and they reassured me. The chocolates weren't labeled European. They came from different countries, including France and Belgium. But the fact that the announcers were calling these bonbons European, assuming their listeners wouldn't care if the chocolates were Belgian, French, or German, was worrying. Why, when I lived in Europe, the French hated Belgian chocolate, and the Belgians hated French chocolate, and as for German chocolate...
If you go into Germany, for example, you will only find hard centers, nuts centers, Jean Dujard centers. Now, the Belgian chocolates, I think, are very famous for the whipped cream and the buttercream centers.
That's Pierre Valert of Callebaut, the Belgian chocolate factory. And those creamy Belgian bonbons he's talking about are huge and outrageously sweet. I met him in 1990 when the New York Times assigned me a story on Le Chocolat Belge, a challenging assignment for a diabetic. Tasting was essential. So, to get a second opinion on Belgian praline, or filled chocolates, I took some to France's most famous chocolatier, Christian Constant, in his shop on the Rue du Bac in Paris. Here, the tiny, elegant chocolates made right on the spot are so bitter, a diabetic can eat his or her fill. But it wasn't easy to get Monsieur Constant to take even a bite of the Belgian chocolate creation I offered him. It was from Manon, one of Belgium's finest bonbon makers, and it was called the Sputnik. This was a chocolate spaceship 2.25 inches long and 3/4 inch in diameter. The dark chocolate nose was filled with orange-flavored crème fraîche, and the paler chocolate fuselage was filled with Cointreau-laced marzipan. Monsieur Constant acted as if I were offering him candy. To him, that's a dirty word.
Oh, that's a candy, you know, that's not chocolate for myself.
Could you bear to eat it?
J'ai pas envie, hein?
No, he doesn't want to eat it. You don't have to eat the whole thing.
It's a shortening cream inside. C'est une crème à la margarine. Shortening, you know? And very sweet. Mm-hmm. I hate this.
Really?
Okay. I hate this.
He hates it.
And Monsieur Valert was dismissive of French chocolate.
And the French chocolate are an average taste, has an average taste.
But French chocolate was the purest until the Europeans got united. Until then, it was against the law in France for chocolatier to use artificial vanilla or any fats except cocoa butter. The EU allows these impurities. So who can blame France for saying no to the European Constitution? French gastronomy is a deeply important aspect of French culture. And if that constitution had been ratified, giving the Brussels bureaucracy even more power, who knows? The boxes of chocolates offered on public radio might have actually been labeled European, and bottles labeled European wine might have appeared in our neighborhood liquor stores.
Our visit to the world of European chocolate, or rather French and Belgian chocolate, was produced by Alice Furlow. For a link to the chocolate shops Alice visited, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. And now an update on a story that we've been following. Earlier this month, we told you about the world's first solar sail-powered spacecraft, Cosmos One. The Russian Space Agency is now reporting that the spacecraft crashed shortly after takeoff yesterday. The Planetary Society of Pasadena, California, had teamed up with the Russians on the project. Once in orbit, Cosmos One was supposed to unfurl a 100-foot petal-shaped solar sail. Light particles would push against the sail, powering the spaceship into orbit. Solar sails are seen as the best hope for interstellar travel because the spacecraft would constantly accelerate, reaching speeds of 100,000 miles an hour within 3 years. This is the sound of sacred harp singing, or shape note singing. It's an American folk tradition that dates back to the 18th century and can still be heard in some parts of the country today. The songs are from a 150-year-old hymn book called The Sacred Harp. It's created by singers shaping the notes of the songs with their mouths, keeping their arms bent at the elbows and their palms facing inward. Last year, Maggie Holtzberg, folklorist with the Massachusetts Cultural Council, went to an all-day sacred harp sing at Holly Springs Primitive Baptist Church in Bremen, Georgia, where she brought us this piece.
I think sacred harp is really what the world needs, and perhaps they just don't know it, because you have good food, good company, and the music is heavenly.
Sacred harp, also known as shape note singing or fa sol la, is a tradition of unaccompanied four-part singing with roots in colonial New England. Itinerant singing masters, faced with teaching music to the untrained, devised a notation system to make the reading of music easier to learn. The shape of a note, triangle, circle, square, or diamond, corresponds with a particular syllable, which in turn tells the singer what pitch to sing. First, each song is sung through once using the fa sol la syllables, and immediately following, the lyrics are sung. Books that are printed in shape notes was once common in 19th century America. But by the turn of the century, such singing disappeared, with the exception of some southern holdouts. Within the last decade, however, there has been a remarkable revival of this tradition. Singing groups have been forming all across the country, with the participation of southern singers who have kept their tradition alive.
I think the primitive Baptists are the ones that kept sacred harp alive because of their music and their worship was all a cappella. They were the only religion in the country that didn't have musical instruments. So, really, I think that's what kept it alive.
As custom has it, sacred harp singers gather annually at host churches and sing throughout the day, breaking midday for a traditional dinner on the grounds. During the singing, men, women, and children arrange themselves by voice parts, forming a hollow square into which the leader steps.
153. Hold it.
Experienced elders and newcomers alike are encouraged to take their turn leading a song. Having been asked to lead, I made my way to the center and stood facing the tenors.
Yes, that's the tenor part, and that is the lead part in the singing. the alto sits right behind you. Your back is to the alto and facing the tenor. The treble is on your left, and then the bass is on the right. It's divided into the square and the four parts.
I didn't really know what I was doing, but had only to rely on the strong voices of male tenors to carry me through. And the sound, there's no better place to be than in the center of that hollow square.
Have you never lived? Well, then you know that you can hear all four parts, and it is so beautiful. It many times brings tears to people's eyes.
As far as sacred art singing, I was raised on.
For many of the middle-aged and older people I spoke with attending this particular singing, Holly Springs is a family tradition.
Many of these families have been friends with each other for almost 200 years. And of course, any new singer is well-loved, and it takes a few years for them to have their memories just like you will have yours. But those are things that money can't buy.
I didn't know anything about La Mary. Other than, you know, I'd come to sing it, I'd never sing. But, you know, if you live with something, you're going to pick it up a little bit at once in a while. And my wife's whole family, they've been in it for, I guess, 100 years or more.
In addition to being astonished by the welcome I felt as an outsider to this tradition, I was struck by the generous sense of community that the singers themselves experience.
Well, I have been going to Sacred Harp singings since I was a little girl. And my family has sung Sacred Harp for, my children are the fifth generation of my family that has sung Sacred Harp. So every Sacred Harp singing that I attend is a memorial singing.
And I've been coming to Holly Springs since I was a child, I guess. And I'm not going to tell you how long that's been. But I've been singing Sacred Harp all my life.
Why do you think it endures, why the Sacred Harp singing tradition endures and people keep coming back?
Oh, other than the music being wonderful, it's the people. It's people.
Spiritual.
Well, it is spiritual, but it's the people that you love, you know, and you like to be with them, you like to hold them and touch them and sit by them and sing with them.
You don't hardly ever see us, when we meet somebody, we would generally hug tonight, whether they want to be hugged or not.
One of the things that is you can really be down, you can really be not feeling well, you can be depressed, you could have just lost a loved one, and you get among these people, and they just love you so much, you just forget all your troubles, don't you?
That's right.
The fellowship that these people have, and the love that they have for one another, it's not found in any kind of organized religion anywhere. They don't care who you are, where you come from, or how you got here, just as long as you come help them sing.
Maggie Holtzberg is a folklorist for the Massachusetts Cultural Council. Her visit to the Sacred Harp Sing at Holly Springs Primitive Baptist Church in Bremen, Georgia, was originally recorded for Georgia Public Radio. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young will be back tomorrow. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.